I am a librarian. I've worked on the Midnight Museum contests. I've been involved with Radical Reference for just a very short while now, but I've been kind of aware of the work that they've done for longer. And before working with Radical Reference, I worked years ago with Blackout Books and Blue Stockings and various other sort of New York radical culture stuff. And, that's my background.
Sure. So I'm Melissa, and I'm a member of Radical Reference, and I work in a branch of Brooklyn Public Library. And I'm sort of just here for the ride. I'm also, as you can probably tell, working on the book fair, so I may have to jump out to answer the phone or something. But I'm sort of here to be helpful as I can.
Okay, and for the gentleman who just came in, we just went around the room and introduced ourselves to try and get a sense of what we're looking for in this workshop. So, if you would like to do that, and if we are being recorded, so if you would like to not be recorded, let us know. We'll switch it off.
I'm Anthony.
General interest, that's fine. All right, my name is John Beekman. I am a librarian in the local history department at the Jersey City Public Library. Those of you who are New Yorkers, Jersey City is that place over on the other side of the Hudson River, like when you're in the village and you look over there, it's next to Hoboken. Okay, well, it sounds like, just to address your questions, and we could probably get together later. I don't know if you follow the news from New Jersey. Most New Yorkers don't, but, we're facing similar issues there in that, and I know, there are campaigns going on through the public libraries to further support for that, and postcard campaigns and New York City Radical Reference is signing on to that. We haven't really talked about doing any organizing per se behind that.
Maybe we can sort of do a little bit of a broader two sentences on what's going on for the rest of people in the room that might not know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay.
I'm not a public library person, so I think it might be better.
All right. Well, in these times of fiscal cutbacks all around the country and in local areas as well, a lot of funding for public services such as libraries is being threatened, and library services, which tend to serve the community and especially for disadvantaged communities, economically less sound communities, poorer communities, if you will, that their only access to information, only access to the internet for I forget what the number is, I don't want to just make it up top of my head, but a surprisingly large number of people only can get access to the internet through public libraries, to take an important example. And, there are funding cuts to libraries that threaten these services. And, one of the goals of the public libraries is to create an informed citizenry, who can effectively participate in their government and, to put that forth at an anarchist book fair. I'm aware of the irony behind that, but in terms of dealing with the present moment, it's better to have,
whatever level they
need.
Know what's going on, if that's what it is.
To really engage
that
question.
Know where a march is, if that's what it is.
Yeah, right. To raise the, to go into that question is beyond our scope here. But so that is the things that are, staff is being cut in public libraries. Services are being cut in public libraries. And
hours.
Hours are being cut. So these are things that library workers have to organize just in their own self-interest and in the interest of the community, because you don't go into this field to get rich, believe me. So that's...
Just one quick thing. I think a really good example of the reason people might really need the internet. It's like, if you're looking to have a job and you have absolutely no access to get an email, for example, many jobs require that you submit applications all the time, or that you contact or have an email contact address. And with that, without that simple thing, and the library is the only place you can get that, then that's just a very concrete example. But
okay. A lot of government publications only online these days. So with that, a lot of the other issues that were raised really go to the core of what we were hoping to do here today. So and since it took us a while to get rolling, we should probably just jump in. We're going to be in three parts today. First, I'm going to kind of go through, we have this guide to the New York City Public Libraries here and some other things. So if any of you haven't picked that up and you want to look at it, you can. We have copies here. Should I pass this around?
I just went around
the room. Went around the room. You're way ahead of me. I'm not paying attention. And also this, a lot of it is hot linked on our site, and you'll see the URL of our site on that, Radical Reference.
We're here. Come in here.
Okay,
that's
all right. Thank you. So I'll kind of go through that and explain what some of those links are. Real quickly, and then we also have a guide to some alternative collections that are housed in libraries, because, you know, I think one of the things people go to an anarchist book fair is to find things that are outside the mainstream, presumably, and, you know, some of those things are collected in libraries, both, you know, public and academic and other resources on the web, so we're going to give you some pointers to that, and also, especially maybe of interest to those of you who said you were students who want some help with research, want to recommend some academic library subject guides or some other subject guides that you can find, and encourage you to explore that option. Because I think to seek information, you know, within the past 10 years, especially 20 years maybe, it goes by pretty quick, we've all come to rely on search engines. I mean, Google has become a verb, right? You're looking for information, you want to Google, you're going to Google it, right? And it's the first place I go, too, you know, I'll be honest. But you may have noticed, a lot of noise in those results. You know, there's just too much information, and one of the things that the resources we can point you at here is to try and cut through the clutter and find a better direct way, A, to things that you could possibly find through the internet, and also to some things maybe that you can't find through search engines on what has been called the invisible web, you know, ways to get into deeper sources of information. And with that, all these resources will be linked on this page. You'll find a blog post for this session on Back to Your Library. It's right at the top of recent blog posts. It should hang there for a little while. So with that, I'm just going to jump into this page here. And this sort of follows along with that handout. Now, obviously, you think of libraries, a lot of you are going to think of books, and the New York City public libraries certainly have a lot of those, and one of the best ways to find that is through their catalogs. That doesn't need much explanation. I'm not going to spend too much time on that. I should mention, those of you, you know, who are new to the city or don't realize, there are three public library systems in the city. New York Public Library covers Manhattan, the Bronx and Staten Island, and then there is Brooklyn Public Library and Queens Public Library, which cover, you know, what you would expect. But of the three public library catalogs, one that I thought would be interesting to look at is the one that Queens is using now, because it uses an interesting information visualization program. Let's use a new tab. That is helpful in finding other sources.
Okay,
let's just not use another tab. Yeah, let's just go that way. So what this is is a visualization that can help you find related subjects as well as searching on a subject you want for. So I'm just going to be really obvious and say, you know, what does the Queen's Public Library have on anarchism?
Spell it right.
It would help if you spell it right. But you know something? This being the modern age, you don't have to spell things. Okay, so first of all, this, you know, you see a nice results list. That's very good. And they have, you know, how many titles? 359 related to anarchism. It's not bad for a public library. The Queen's is a very good public library system. What I want to draw your attention to over here, though, is this here on our left, stage right, which shows you a map of related terms, which can help you find other books on related subjects. So you could say, like, maybe if you're interested in anarchism, you might want to look at what's syndicalism, if you're looking into particular types of anarchist thinking. And then from that, you can see... We're all looking at the same word right now, I'm pretty sure, and it's not syndicatos. So you could say, well, here's some what the computer thinks is related subjects. And, you know, as you can see, there might be some noise. And, you know, the relationship of syndicalism to cannibalism is something I would certainly like to explore, but it's beyond our scope right now. But, you know, by and large, you can see that this will lead you to related titles.
And to sort of interject quickly, you were talking about browsing. Like, that's the kind of serendipity that, for whatever reason, even if it's a silly one, you can get still by doing these open searches. You can still stumble upon random things, and maybe it's useful for whatever reason that might be.
And also, you know, on this, you know, for those of us who don't have the privilege of living in Queens, you can, you know, use this catalog to find books that you might want to find either through a public library you do have access to, or, you know, on interlibrary loan from your libraries. We're all familiar with, somebody mentioned interlibrary loan. Is that, like, concept based, generally understood? It's easy for librarians to go into libraries. I don't think I am. You look like you're... What is that?
Well, I work at a library. Okay. I live in New Jersey, and the governor, I don't know who else does, but the governor proposed a budget cut, and the library loan is going to be cut now.
Yeah. We were just talking about that a minute ago. I work in Jersey City, so yes.
Just that interlibrary loan is different from if you have a library system like our three city systems with multiple branches, because when you're requesting a book from another branch but it's within the same system, usually the term used is you're putting a hold on it. But interlibrary loan is when you're borrowing outside of the library system. So if you were using your Brooklyn card to try to get a New York Public Library item. So.
Okay. And also, I believe that the three metropolitan library systems have like a pass card. You get like a metro thing. Do you know how that works here?
In New York. I think that has to do more with research collections.
Okay.
And gaining access to the Buffs Library, for example, I can get access to, if you go to New York Public and request a metro card, as a New York Public Library or Queens or Brooklyn user, you can gain access to private university library with a Metro card. So there are opportunities for people who aren't in colleges or universities, who are just regular people, to use top quality university library through the public library. So that's a very good benefit as well.
Yeah.
You have to prove something or have
No,
you or show your library card. Well, you have to demonstrate a research need. Maybe the Folks Library has a book that New York Public's copy has gone missing, or they have a larger collection on this particular topic, or a particular edition that you want, or you don't really have to sign away. You don't have to document with, you know, real specificity. Just demonstrate some need to use that collection, and you can ask for a Metro card.
But if it's just one title that you're looking for, that you know, you don't even have to know who owns it, but if it's something that your public library doesn't own, you can just request interlibrary loan at your local branch, and you don't have to prove something. It's just a one title need. And, I mean, we're lucky in the New York systems, I assume Queens as well, that you can request any print material, and through the New York public system, you can also request documentaries. Last I heard, you can't try to interlibrary loan feature films, I guess.
But
documentary films you can try to get through interlibrary loan.
Okay, I'm just going to try and keep moving here. While we're in the library catalog, I would also, you know, to go into the question of browsing the stacks and the virtual virtual analog to that is each, you know, book record, you know, or catalog record, the description will often contain subjects, and in most, you know, online catalogs, each of these subjects will be linked to, you know, will be hot linked. So you can find books on, you know, you can get to that individual subject. So if you're looking at, you know, a book that you know has been useful to you or looks useful to you, you can see what subject descriptions have been attached to that, and then you can, you know, you can use the online catalog to find other books on that subject. So that's an important tool that's, you know, kind of like that wandering the stacks feeling. So now I have to use the back to get back. This is why I wanted to use the alternate tab method. But okay, now all the libraries, the three public libraries, have other resources available, both, you know, that you can use within the library for finding journal articles, you know, in academic and popular journals or magazines, if you will. And also, they have some organized internet links as well to sort of help you sort of cut through the clutter and find subject-related websites rather than just, you know, Googling the subject you're into, seeing, you know, the 7 million links, you know, that Google will give you, and maybe getting through the first three pages of them, you know. So I just want to take a look at maybe one of these in the interest of time. So with these, will these be most useful to you if you either are on site at one of the public libraries on their computers, or if you have a library card and can log into their site, because these journals will be available through subscription. You know, the libraries pay for them. And so,
I'm actually connected by proxy through Queens College and NYPL. So, if you want to look on there, you should be able to get on without that.
Okay, so that's good. We can demonstrate a little bit. You can see here they have a handy, you know, limited by subject. So let's see. What should we look for? Any suggestions on what we should look for? Let's make this interactive. No? Well, you can see a lot of us might be interested as an anarchist in finance. This is the kind of situation where, you know, I should have had some prepackaged results in searches that I was going to show you people, but that's just not how I roll. So you can see Business Source Premier from EBSCO, and we can log in. All right, so through each of the libraries, EBSCO is a major database provider, and what that means is they sell these databases, or, you know, ways to get access to information through a variety of packages. So you can see there's a history one, there's an economics one, there's sort of a general one. So each of these are useful for different things, and you can see this. Each one will have a little description of what you can find through there. And there's, you know, there are some multidisciplinary ones like this. So let's just continue with the corniness. Let's look for an article on anarchists up in New York City. Let's like see if that's what we're interested in. And again, this is really just some basic stuff here. And so you can see some 14 articles, and you can see that there are some from periodicals, encyclopedias. I wonder how Dwight MacDonald would feel about coming up so often in New York City and anarchism. Not the first name I would think of from New York City. So you can see this comes at it from a variety of perspectives, but you can see now this will link you to full text resources for these articles. We're not really doing an information literacy critical thinking piece here, so I won't comment on this, but it's just a matter of this is, you know, you can find information on these subjects in databases, and these are available to you through the public library and, of course, through academic libraries. And a little bit later, we'll go into how you can find appropriate ones in other venues.
And just to make clear for those of you who maybe haven't been at school in a while, or you know haven't been using databases, is that you know this is still like we're still getting those articles and that content online, but we're going through a sort of fee-based route to it. So, for example, the other day I had a patron who was looking for an article from Ebony Magazine from 2001, and she had tried to go to Ebony the Magazine's website to get the article, and she found, you know, whatever she found, just an abstract, and then you would have had to pay for the rest of the text. But our library subscribed to, I think it might have been Masterfile, but one of these types of databases that indexed Ebony going back to, you know, the 90s. So I was able to get that article, and not only the text, but the full PDF, so that there was, you know, you could see the photographs that ran with it. So just to make it clear that sometimes you may be able to find, you know, a hint of something online, just on the open web, but you may need to dig in one of these databases to find the full text. And this, you know, there's all these levels of relationships, like John mentioned, EBSCO's the vendor, so there's EBSCO, and then there's, you know, Ebony Magazine, and there's all the companies, and then the libraries that buy it. So it's not
takeaway, I think,
right? And
the user is that if you run into stuff that you want on the open web and you're only getting a little bit of it, talk to the library, go to the library, and you might find a lot more. And there's a lot of stuff happening behind the scenes to make that happen.
And if your teacher or professor tells you that you cannot use the internet, do not think that means you cannot use a database, right? Because
yes, this does not count as using the internet.
As a citation.
As a citation, yes. I said I was only going to look at one of those links, but actually, while we were talking, I looked at Brooklyn Public Library's e-resources page, and I have to say that it's a lot more what I was hoping to see than when I went to the New York Public's, which seemed a little daunting to me. This is very nice. Brooklyn has, you can see very clearly.
Because we subscribe to a lot fewer than New York.
Because
New York Public hasn't figured out how to organize their information on the web at all.
Yeah.
So here you can see it's a little bit clearer what I was trying to get at. As you can see, you know, various resources by subject, and then you can click through, you know, if you're looking for open interest, it'll give you, you know, what resources they have on that subject. So that's worth playing around with. And Queens also similarly a little bit better organized, a little bit more user-friendly than what we saw at New York Public.
John, are you going to show up on Google Scholar?
Huh? I was not planning on talking about Google Scholar. We probably should.
Just thought one more academic.
Yeah, well, when we come to the the academic piece will. That's a good point. Since we got a late start, I'm starting to feel a little bit rushed. Okay, I think we're okay. Thank you. I need some hand holding sometimes. All right. Well, since it came up then, and we have time. Let's open a new tab. And click. Okay. And I like mice. I don't use these touchpads very often. Google, God bless them, beyond, you know, their great, lovely, basic search directory, which we have all come to love and depend on far too much, offers a variety of other services. But if you find it more, one of the things that they offer is Google Scholar, which I have mixed feelings about, but it's certainly a worthwhile resource for those in the academy, because this is another way to find things through the web that your professor will not count as, like, quoting Wikipedia in your paper.
So it's a good way to do a quick search, for example, for something that is only actually available through a database that you need this sort of secret backdoor connection through the library in a database, say, JSTOR, but you'll automatically seamlessly get it if you're in that relationship by proxy, meaning via some connection home or at the library.
So what's nice about Google Scholar is, first of all, as it has, it links to scholarly resources, but it also has this nice citation information, which when you're trying to rate the quality in information, one thing that's nice to know for academic purposes is how often it's cited by other people. Because that's is this an important thing? Well, how many other people have found it worthwhile to cite in their papers? Which, you know, as an academic practice, maybe that creates a certain amount of incestuousness or something, or an echo chamber. But on the other hand, it's just one way. I wouldn't count it as the only way of counting the value of information, but it's certainly something useful to have. And you can even see, I believe, if you click on this, other people that cite that article or book. So it's just another wonderful way to peruse that and one of the...
And, like, again, talk about browsing. The level of nuance of browsing you're doing, think about it, you know, in its analog form, what it would take to look at a book, look at every citation, look up every citation. And, I mean, that's a pretty phenomenal tool, so...
And you can find related articles, so, and then other options at your college, wherever you happen to be right now. The computer thinks we're at Queen's College. Search in your library. So Google Scholar is a wonderful thing. Oh, right, Queen's College is, of course, CUNY. And now we're back to the screen that I know all so well. Okay, so, minor digression. One other class of information finders that I want to talk about now before we go to maybe a little bit more fun piece and look at some alternative collections are web directories. How many people here have ever used a web directory for their search rather than a search engine? Yeah, it's really good. Well, I'm not even raising my hand. It's web directories are kind of an old-fashioned idea that it's easy to lose sight of, but it's are really wonderful ways of navigating it rather than that just brute force, you know, Google or live search where you just, you know, put in your terms and get 5 million results. Web directories are resources that structure information related by subject. So again, going back to that image of perusing, browsing the library stacks, where books are sorted into information categories. These web directories also do that. And they also include some level of vetting, some level of quality control before things are put into these directories. Different ones have different criteria and are created by different for different purposes. But there's a couple that are worth looking at. And it's you know, as with any search for information, I think it's often best to look in a few different places just because I want to get, you know, as much diversity of information as possible.
Yeah, and I think that the few times that I do use a web directory, I use it for a very broad topic. So we could do a sample search for immigration. Like if I just wanted to know what are websites devoted to a given broad topic where I might be able to find reports and other ways to get to websites that deal with it, I would try Internet Public Library or InfoMine, which was also listed on there. So like John said, you know, if you Google immigration, I mean, you're going to get a million things and who knows what's going to be on top. And so we could try this now.
Yeah. Okay, so what this is, this obviously is a merger of two sites and one that we used to like called the Librarians Index to the Internet, or Librarians Internet Index, was a site created by librarians, and so was the Internet Public Library. These are two services. They're both based in California, I think, and they have fairly recently merged their services into one. So all of the websites that you'll find on here have been contributed by librarians, you know, who have some subject knowledge and who have, you know, kind of looked at it and said, this is good information, this is worthwhile. And, you know, that's kind of what we're trained to do, so maybe that's a good thing. And they also have, you know, before we try was a search, I'm just going to point out the actual directory aspect of this is resources by subject. And again, you can find broad subjects, and then you can drill down within those. So, you know, so there's some general social sciences resources, and then anthropology, education, ethnicity, culture, and race. So again, for whatever subject you're interested in, you can find some internet resources that librarians somewhere have thought would be, you know, valuable and worthy of your time.
And have annotated. You know, these descriptions are human written. It's not like Google where it's just a snippet of your keywords and context. These are human selected and annotated.
So, and again, it's just another way, sort of a more old-fashioned way of searching for information, starting from a broad topic description and kind of drilling down to more specific levels of information through these subject descriptions. Now, obviously, a lot of that depends on, you know, who created the description and whether you can find the right mindset to find the way through that to the information you're looking for. And, you know, one way to help do that is to, you know, use a search within the site. So it's like you can, you know, rather than drilling down through the subject guide, you might want to just search the site, and this will, you know, function more like we've all become used to. Did I spell it right for a change? I did. I got this one right. Awesome. This will function more like we've all become used to typing into a search engine and seeing what you get, but with the benefit of, instead of getting God knows how many results you would have gotten for immigration in live search, you know, we're going to get 232 resources that, you know, someone has described as being worthwhile for them. So you can see stories on the immigration debate, so-called, I guess, immigration statistics, immigration, the law, and you. So much more, you know, much less overwhelming than, you know, just trying to start from, you know, a regular internet search. And you know, again, Google's going to give you a frightening amount of hits, and maybe there's a lot of stuff, good stuff in there. And but the thing is, the problem with that is there might be something really good on the 30th page of that results list. And has anybody here ever gotten past the 5th page of a results list on a Google search? Yeah, right. Are you in library school? Because that level of compulsivity, you should be. Because I have it. And I mean that. I hope you take that in the way that I mean it. That's awfully familiar of me to joke like that.
And a compliment, of course.
It is. I mean that in the best possible way. Okay. So the DMoz, which is a Mozilla project, anybody that uses Firefox will be familiar with Mozilla. This is grew out of that same community that developed Firefox, the Mozilla community, and this is an older project of theirs. But again, it's similar websites. They're submitted not by professional librarians, but it's still good, you know. And again, structured the same way, by broad subjects that you can drill down through, and then also, you know, you can search within and find, you know, subdirectories related to that. So society, issues, immigration, you'll find 62 sites. So you get the idea, and this is a very good, you know, it's Open Directory Project. Mozilla is an outfit that's very, you know, involved in the open source movement and, you know, collaborative information and collaborative technology growth, which I think is compatible with the ideals, you know, the best ideals that fall under the general rubric of anarchism. You know, I think the open source movement is certainly compatible with that.
And if you don't, I'm going to interject, if you don't have or don't know about Zotero, it's another citation manager that's offered free through Mozilla. So if you're doing a lot of, you know, if you're in school or doing an independent research project or whatever, and you want to be able to organize all of your sources, it's an excellent way to do that. And it's all, you know, cloud computing and that kind of thing. But it'll keep your sources, your citations straight for you.
Right. So it's sort of like a non-proprietary endnotes kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
So basically, it's a way to organize lots of different stuff. So if you're in need of a way to organize lots of stuff, look it up and talk to people and they can help you sort it out if it's not given it to you, because I wasn't even that would spend some time.
I wanted to show the Triple Dub Virtual Library, because this is a significant one in that this is probably the oldest web directory, because it was actually created by Tim Berners-Lee and the folks at CERN who pretty much invented the internet as we know it, the hypertext.
The World Wide Web.
The World Wide Web as we know it, that's right. I'm sorry. We should not certainly use them interchangeably, especially in this context. Right? So the idea of typing a web address using that hypertext transfer, that, you know, came from Tim Berners-Lee and the folks at CERN. And this is their web directory guide. So, you know, props to them. And another good, you know, you'll see different research. You'll probably see a lot of the same ones within all of them, but you'll see some different ones, and it's you know, it's worth looking at a few of them. I'm going to do InfoMine last, because I want to look at Best of the Web. Is another one. This one I would, you know, be a little bit used with more of a grain of salt, because this is much more of a commercial venture. But it's just another good directory. And, you know, I like to give people options, so I'm not going to say too much more about that. InfoMine is a little bit different in that it is very much academically oriented.
Which one was Best of the Web?
Yeah, Best of the Web is more of a, was more of a commercial.
Yeah, I got
project.
It there. Then.
BOTW.org.
N-R-T-S.
Huh? Yeah?
Houston.
Okay. Info, I know, that's good, thanks. I don't use it that often, so, but, you know, user review is always welcome. InfoMine is a little bit more academically oriented. So this is for those of you, especially university students, this is another sort of general purpose internet resource. So let's see what they have on immigration, just to go with that. If that's what you're... So this is sort of a little bit more structured than Google Scholar, which is going to get you, you know, a lot of stuff, you know, it being Google and all. This is, I'll give you 721 sort of academic oriented websites on immigration. So that's WebDirectory.
How does it compare to JSTOR?
Well, JSTOR is like we talked about EBSCO before. They're a vendor of a particular database. So JSTOR is a collection of journals, you know, a collection of print resources compiled and then searchable through their search engine. You know.
But for example, when you're searching like Google, you might get JSTOR articles that you can't access unless you're in a place like a library or by proxy, like at a library where you've signed in from your home computer, and then you might be able to get to that full resource.
Yeah.
And JSTOR is good for specific sorts of articles, and you can look on, some libraries will give you a list of every publication that JSTOR that's included in your JSTOR subscription. And it's also worth noting that there are different types of subscriptions to JSTOR, so you want to be aware of what subscription the library you're using has, because they have different collection of things.
So how is that different?
InfoMine is an index of websites. It's not an index of articles.
Okay. It's more... Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think they really hit the ads. It's really it's websites.
Didn't mean to jump into the trees rather than the forest rather than the trees.
Okay, so now I see, you know, we've only got about a half hour left, so I want to stop talking for a while. God help us. And maybe Kate would like to talk a little bit about some of the second piece of this presentation today, some alternative collections.
And I'll make sure to stop early enough that we can have general questions and feel free to interject with any specific questions and general to whatever I'm specific meaning about anything I say or don't say or say comprehensively. Okay, so we have here a list of just kind of some cool collections that exist. And I think it's good because some of these might be of specific interest, but more importantly, the like basic takeaway is that lots of neat things that you don't expect exist in libraries, and I think it's worth noting at an anarchist book fair exists within like universities and public libraries and places you really wouldn't expect them. And I think one thing that's really neat about libraries in general is that it's a place where really sort of under the cuff radical things happen. The example I always use that I think is neat is that, you know, our federal mainstream taxes go to letting 16-year-olds borrow some CDs for free. That's cool.
And this last few words?
Borrow Smith CDs for free, so I'm just saying borrow rock music. And I just think that sort of illustrates, you know, a lot of the things on this list are kind of pretty alternative stuff and in pretty mainstream places. And rather than go into the access issues that... for each place, just kind of keep in mind that, as the person who just left said, you know, different places have different access issues, and basically you have to be a they want to cater to a self-selected group, but that doesn't mean that as a member of the public, you can't figure it out. So look at the access notes on each web page, and they'll tell you about what you can, what you, the hoops you have to jump through, but basically they're free and they're available to the public.
I just to interrupt real quick, I spoke to somebody yesterday at the Fales Library and said, you know, what's it like if a member of the public wants to come in? So you basically have to call and you'll get the head of the department will write you a letter that you can come in. You know? So you'll have to show ID, but they're pretty, you know, if you have, if you see a collection you'd like to see, you can't just come in and say, I want to see this collection, they'll work with you in the chair.
I mean, basically, you have to jump through some hoops because they want to limit the number of people. But it is a self-selected group, which means, you know, you get to do the selecting for the most part. It just involves jumping through some hoops.
Kate, could you talk a little about the difference between accessing special collections and archives versus generally available materials in the libraries, just to draw a distinction there between why they might want to limit?
Archives are usually exist within a separate department of a library or of a university or of an institution, even if they're housed in the library. And it's usually primary source material. So it's like somebody's letters, somebody's notes, somebody's journals, photographs, things that are different than books or sort of widely circulated material. Is that answer if you have anything to interject?
I don't think that your anybody's first entry point into a body of information should be through an archive or a special collection. You should be walking into that space having some background knowledge.
Absolutely.
And then you can contextualize the stuff that you're looking at.
It's really specific stuff by the time you want to look at an archive. If you're doing some serious research and are interested in the correspondence between so-and-so at such-and-such a time, you want to know exactly what you're looking for. That said, you know, to do serious research, that's your call about what that means. You just need to sort of be able to articulate it and think about what you do. So here you'll see there's some discussion of the types of what their policy is with regards to this particular collection, the Downtown Collection, which is super cool. Show going on, I think, currently at Fales, which is downstairs, and at the Gray Gallery, which is a few blocks away from here. And they collect sort of documents of the culture from the downtown art scene in Soho in the 70s through the 90s. And it's neat, like pretty radical stuff. There was a whole set of programming involved with it, or as a component of it, talks and things. And this, so if you kind of want to have a sense of what the sensibility is, it says, you know, there's the general guidelines, retrospective collecting, which means older stuff, prospective collecting, which is, I guess, things that as they come out, etc. So Fowles is a really nice collection. They also recently received a Riot Girl collection, which is a music-type political culture movement from the 90s, which many of you may be familiar with. And this is a discussion of what that is, and that's what that collection consists of. And the purpose of collecting it, which will provide primary resources for scholars who are interested in feminism, punk, activism, queer theory, gender theory, DIY culture, and music history. These are primary sources, again, original documents for scholars, historians, cultural studies people, to whatever to interact with.
And, you know, that's one of the things when you look at something like that, you might think about, you know, like any of us who are pack rats and collectors. I mean, basically what that is like Catherine Hanna, like, collect your stuff and didn't throw any of her flyers away for years. And then at one point said, well, you know, I have all this stuff. It documents a really special place and time. that was really not documented well in the mainstream media by choice. I mean, at one point, I think a lot of those people said, we're not getting covered the way we want to, so we're just going to, it's a media blackout. And so that, you know, stuff comes to a research institution and later on people can find out about that.
And that's something that you discuss a lot as a librarian and in library school, that what gets collected, that's why it's very important that they have these notes on what the collecting policies are, because a lot doesn't get collected. A lot of times they'll say, no, that's not within our, what they call scope, which means, you know, general guidelines. And so it's important that that's transparent, because interacting with it as a researcher, especially a teacher, you need to know what didn't get collected and why did these things get collected. And, you know, so that's an ongoing conversation among librarians. And as a lay person that might be collecting lots of neat stuff on anarchist culture, it's something to think about long term. And I think John had something to say about where you choose to donate stuff to, if that's something you choose to do.
Well, yeah, a little bit later, there isn't that much later to go, but there was a great zine collection that was put together by the guy who did Fact Sheet 5, which was like an early zine review publication. And that, you know, he donated his collection to the New York State Library up in Albany about over 10 years ago. And it's really, like, I was going to look for it because I wanted to highlight it here, and there's really no finding aid for it. I mean, they've got some of it in their regular collection. It's very disappointing, because that's would be a very important document of, you know, what was going on in zine culture in the 80s and 90s, because how many people sent their zines to Fact Sheet 5 to be reviewed?
So the bottom line is, once it gets to the library, it's the library's job to treat it well, and that means processing it, which means making it visible to you in whatever way. So here we are at the Tamanit. This is the labor archives, to the history of the labor movement in New York. And
a neat distinction about the Tamanit is that it is actually public, so you can get a guest pass downstairs through the boats, but you don't have to show any credentials to come up here.
Oh, that's
excellent. And if you want to like look at primary source archival material, then you're going to need to get a reader card and you know, do a little bit more, you know, proving, but it's not much. Everything else up here is, they were very specific about making this a public access archive.
And they have lots of neat collections, including Fairness and Accuracy in Ordering. And here, this is what's called a finding aid. So this is an archive rather than something that's like a book or a collection of books. It's a collection of papers. And this is what a finding aid looks like. You'll have a descriptive summary at the top, dates, an abstract, like of the kind you find at the beginning of the paper that just sort of describes it. And then the quantity is described in linear feet and translated in parentheses. So if you don't know what 0.75 linear feet is, don't worry, it's a box that you would go through. But it's important to know exactly what you want, because sometimes it's a whole bunch of linear feet and there are lots of boxes and they need to know exactly what you need. And then you have this note, scope, arrangement describes how it's arranged, and that stuff is important because, you know, if it's arranged alphabetically, that sort of gives you context. Some things will be arranged chronologically, and that's quite different. And so it's important to look at those things and understand that you're looking at it, that it's being contextualized. You know, in life, I think information is always presented within a certain context. History is presented within a certain context, the yada, yada, yada. And I think libraries are good in doing their best to adhere to the mission of making transparent what that context is. You may agree with it, you may not, but they try hard, librarians and archivists, to describe for you why things are being presented in the order they're being presented. And that's something that I think is important. And this gives you access restrictions, which is open for research without restrictions. That's very neat. And you can have a sense of various access points, which means, you know, who are you, you're interested in knowing about Jeff Cohn, or the fairness or inaccuracy in reporting the organization, or different and, you know, subjects, or different types of material. So there's correspondence and writings and et cetera. And then this explains exactly what's where. They have other neat things here, including an anarchist collection that has all sorts of things. Archival collections, books, so that's not necessarily primary source material. There's oral histories, which is neat. Serials, which means like magazines, periodicals, things that come out more than once, and are intended to come out more than once. And here we have one of these. We have databases and websites, which is kind of like one of these web indexes we talked about. Accidental shameless self-promotion.
They have a little photo exhibit up there that you can get through the site, which we should probably not look at now, or else we'll just spend hours in there.
And recently they got the Time's Up donated a collection to them, and can you mention what Time's Up is? I'm not too familiar.
I mean, it's a local environmental organization, and they are also a great resource for bicyclists. They run how to repair your bike workshops, and they run bike rides and are part of other demonstrations, actions, parties related to transportation and environment.
So that's an example of something that has not been processed yet, which means there's no information about what's there online anymore, because they haven't gone through it and described it and done the work of putting it in the database. So it's forthcoming. But there's links here to a Gothamist post about it and a New York Times article about it.
And something to remember about archival collections too is that they're never going to describe at the item level, so you're never going to find documentation that like this particular letter, unless it's like from freaking like Thomas Jefferson or something, is that this letter exists in this folder in this box. It's always going to be described in kind of a
what's in the box.
There's too much stuff.
So you'll be description of this box exists and has letters and.
Right, so you're never going to get like a description like you would get for a book, which is why archives are fun and frustrating.
And then, those are called collection level descriptions, just so that's a useful term to know that that's what that means. Item level would be a description of the actual book, one-to-one correlation. We put here some other just kind of interesting things, such as, because I wanted to kind of highlight that they're really cool, weird, interesting libraries. Ohio State University, which I don't know if the name it is a bastion of radicalism, but I'm a cartoon person, and they have a cartoon art library. And I just kind of want to point that out because it's the kind of thing you wouldn't think that a university has, or that there's this library that's specifically about that kind of a thing, and there does. And it's, if you learn a little bit about the world of libraries, it's actually not that surprising at all. And they have interesting collections, they have a database. So we won't waste our time looking at that right now, but it's a good, if you're specifically interested in it, it's the coolest thing on the planet. If you're not, it's good to know that exists, that kind of thing exists, and something comparable does. Catholic Worker Archives at Marquette University. Dorothy Day was a wonderful radical who started the Catholic Worker Movement, and they have a table at the book fair tomorrow, so that's, I highly suggest looking at their the kind of work they do. They run a soup kitchen, various communities, a newspaper, and here is Dorothy Day, who's an important person's papers.
Since you brought up Ohio, Bowling Green University in Ohio actually has a massive zine library as well. So I think it's actually, I've heard that it's the largest in the country.
And we'll take a look at some zine libraries too. Great, thank you. That's good to know. Lots of universities.
I'm not sure how available it is online or to people outside of the university, but it's
great, thank you. Some public libraries have circulating zine collections, like Seattle does. Does New York Public doesn't have circulating zines.
So we only have a few minutes left, so let's kind of just sort of run through this and then we'll take questions. So I have a few more universities that have interesting things. North Texas has digital collections from government sources. Connecticut has an alternative press collection. George Washington hosts something called the National Security Archive, which is interesting from an anarchist point of view. They sort of focus on, it's not actually government related, and they collect and publish declassified documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. Good to know.
A lot of stuff that was obtained through the Freedom of Information Act is hosted on that site. Great stuff.
Chris Dodge used to write for the Unneeded Reader, and he has a list of some cool alternative library collections that exist within NYPL, the Wisconsin Historical Society,
Bowling Green University,
Popular Culture Library. So there are lots of, there are good ways to, places to collate this kind of thing. The IPC in Oregon does some great work that resources for independent publishers. Holt Library is a radical labor library in San Francisco. So that's a great
collection. Labadee Collection, where Julie Hirata was.
Journal of Aesthetics and Protest has some nice, it's an independent organization with a slide library that looks like that. And we have a list here of zine libraries, Barnard, Salt Lake City, ABC in Rio. I work at MoMA, we have a bunch of zines. One is, and I put here just like a bibliography of a particular collection that was held to, it stays in sort of one group because it was donated by the same person, and it's organized into countries. This part is, I guess, organized into, I just went through it and organized into countries. There are a lot of things from Eastern Europe and Central and South America, etc. And I just kind of wanted to note also that, again, really mainstream places, including Harvard, Princeton, NYPL, have all sorts of neat things. Harvard just got Polaroid's archives. NYPL just did a show based on an archive that they have of Yaddo, the writer's column, that my archives teacher actually put together. So spent a lot of time hearing about that. So that's just basically random sampling of some cool stuff that exists, and lots of other cool stuff exists, and I guess we should take questions for the last few minutes.
I have a really good things to show before we go to questions. I have one more set of things to show.
Okay.
Before we go to questions. So, take that. We had a little technical issues at the beginning, and also, surprisingly enough, over-prepared for this, which is certainly not how I felt this morning. But since there were a few people who said they were students interested in navigating information a little easier, I did want to not skip this in favor of questions, but just to point out that many universities have subject research guides on their library websites that were put together by librarians in consultation with faculty. And you know, you don't necessarily have to use your school's research guides to find resources. I mean, some of them are put together better than others. And I noticed Columbia University has two that were very nice and worth looking at. And you know, we'll have these up on the site, and you know, you can find them and link to them. And I got interested in this. We'll hopefully add some more. But it's worth, you know, you can see through here, you know, you can find a subject guide by subject, and then each of these will link you to both websites that are available, you know, at Columbia, you know, print material that's available, as well as general websites. And you know, say you were interested in anesthesiology, and again, this is one of those situations where I should probably have decided what I was going to look at first, because I now I don't. But it's exciting, right? Who knows what's going to happen? But you can find, you know, various, you know, classes and materials. Some of them. All right, this is a boring one. Internet guides and resources, meta directories. So, now I mentioned that some of the resources that you find at Columbia are only available through Columbia, but I have it on good authority that if you actually are not a Columbia student, but if you just go up to the Columbia campus, or I have it on good authority, this is true at the Barnard campus. And may be true at the Columbia campus. You don't need a login to get into their databases if you're on the campus wireless network. So you can just, if it's a nice day and you want to get some research done at Columbia, you know, using Columbia's libraries, apparently you can just go and sit on the compound there and get directly into their databases without logging in.
And I think that speaks to some slightly more abstract point, I think a good one, is that, like, basically, the ethos of librarianship, the intellectual ethos, is very, very in line with a lot of the things that you might be, issues you might think about as an anarchist or someone who's interested in elements of anarchist philosophy. It's really about transparency and sharing and making information free and accessible to anyone, and librarians will go crazy out of their way for you. You know, email reference questions, if you have questions about anything, to radical reference, but also to academic libraries or public libraries. And it's just, that fact is just a great example of the fact that really, once you're in their jurisdiction, they'll bend over backwards for you in whatever way they can, for the most part.
And also on the, you know, on the anarchist tip, I always like to promote using government documents, you know, because you know that the government, state, local governments, international governments compile a lot of information, and you know, a lot of it is valuable information, and you know, some of it may be very accurate. Like, you know, for regardless of what we may think of the intention of this information being gathered, there's a lot of really accurate information in, say, the CIA World Factbook. You know, that is accessible through websites and through depository libraries. And what I mean by depository libraries is libraries that are contracted to the government to receive government publications and make them accessible to the public. And we talked before about getting access to the Bose Library here if you're not an NYU student. Because this library is a federal depository library, the public has access to that collection here. So if you went downstairs and said, I need to use the government documents, they'll have to show them your ID, but they will let you in, you know, and you can come up to, I forget what floor it's on. And I don't know how closely they watch you once you go there. So I mean, go to the government documents floor. You don't necessarily have to only do government documents research, but you didn't hear that from me. But now Columbia has a lot of good guides to government resources, and you know, I would encourage anyone to use this stuff, because you know, like it or not, our taxes are paying for it. So with that,
paying more for it.
Am I paying more and more? So again, you know, to students, I would encourage you to check both your, you know, your library's subject guides, and some are better than others. You know, I put up a link to Rutgers here because that's where I went to school, and I think they have some really good ones, although there's, you know, a fair amount of dead links in them as well. And having been somebody who is charged with keeping these up to date, I know how that works. But, you know, many libraries have them. Some are better than others if you don't, you know, if you're, and you don't necessarily have to feel like, oh, you know, I'm a CUNY student, so why would I use Columbia's library website? Well, it may be a little bit, you know, organized a little differently, and you can find these guides here. And so with that, I'd like to keep talking more, but we have a couple minutes. We can probably push it a little bit if there's any questions.
I wondered a question of the NYPL when they redesigned their website. Didn't make it easier? Well, maybe they're still working on it.
They're still working on it. Part of the redesign came from the fact that they are merging the branch and the research libraries, and those two libraries used a different ILS, which is the sort of back end system when you search a catalog. And so they had to put all their material, all those records, into that different new ILS, as they call it. And so that's a process that takes a while. I worked on a project to do that with three libraries with very small collections, and it took a year, and it was a very long, arduous process, let alone the most largest ever, is putting all of China in one. So it's going to be a process, and they're well aware of the fact that it's not perfect yet. They've had editorials galore saying so. So hopefully it will get better.
Have they increased the hours so much, and now they're talking about pulling them back, like up to 11 p.m. at night?
I mean, I don't work at NYPL. I don't know if somebody does in this room.
I work for NYPL. They definitely, we've cut hours already. The branch that I used to work at cut 14 hours a week. And they're facing another $33 million budget cut.
You know, I mean, the irony is the more people use libraries in financially strained times, the less money the libraries have.
But it's also a dance every year without me. So, you know, we're not going to lose $33 million. We are going to lose some money.
But till 11 p.m. at the Midland—that's the latest anybody.
Yeah, and I have been there at 10:30 taking my book.
That's pretty awesome.
Anything else? Any questions you started with?
Besides libraries, what places can you go to get Wi-Fi access, like especially at night, for example?
I think a lot of coffee shops.
Brandhurst.
And increasingly, there will be public space, I think, like Philadelphia, maybe.
I know that Bryant Park still has internet access.
There's some public spaces, too. There's a public square or something like that in Midtown. It's open till 9 or 10.
And, you know, I know in addition to, some CUNY campuses, the City University campuses in other boroughs have actual campuses, and some of them are more publicly accessible than others, but I believe they have internet access. Like yesterday, I was up at Lehman College in the Bronx, and you know, you don't have to show any ID to get on campus, but they do have, I saw someone using Wi-Fi on the campus. Now, I'm pretty sure you couldn't get into their databases without a login, but you can, I believe, use them up. So areas around public universities,
fast food restaurants,
a lot of coffee shops, Starbucks,
McDonald's.
Sort of a question about, curious about if you know if any of the libraries are doing any sort of translation services or anything like that. I know, the Flushing branch of the Queenswood Library does a lot of classes, and the one by my apartment, too, in Woodside, has a lot. I was just wondering if there's a general push for more. A bigger language-friendly kind of
approach. I think a lot of that must happen on the branch level, dependent on the population that is there, which is a reason to fill out your census.
Do you mean instruction in other languages, or
I'm wondering if this pertains specifically with archives. So I'm wondering.
That's a good question.
So translation services are collecting
both,
materials,
I guess, yeah.
and alternate languages. Yeah.
I mean, as a general mission, I think, like Angie said, it would be. I mean, she was referring to universities and public libraries too. It would be sort of its own department, the archival or the local history collection. So, on a branch level, there may be services like a conversation group in English or other languages, but no real impetus to save or retain materials except for like at Brooklyn Public Library, we have the Brooklyn Collection, which
there,
hopefully is retaining.
Like my branch would be Italian. And they're sort of coalescing the cataloging in from various branches that are sort of throughout Manhattan into just one place. And so they're cutting down cataloging staff. And what that means is just people who do cataloging, that means describing books and stuff, who do specialty stuff, CJKs, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, for example. Are not being retained necessarily, or if they leave, their jobs aren't being replaced. So that flows a wrench into all of it.
Sure.
This is on the editorializing tip. Like, public libraries are, in my opinion, not very concerned right now with that aspect or with a lot of academic work in general. I think, you know, they're trying to stay open and they're trying to keep their constituents happy, which in a lot of cases means CDs.
But, you know, that's why something that sounds pretty obscure if you don't think, you know, at first, like, catalogers, what's that? And, you know, catalogers cataloging in, you know, the Greek or whatever, what's that? Well, what it is meaning that there can be Greek books and Greek people to find in Greek.
I find a lot of people from all over the world go into libraries, public ones, use the internet.
A couple other cool resources that are just like for free stuff. Project Gutenberg has a lot of free texts available online. And the Internet Archive, I love. If you guys get a chance to browse through that, you can just Google the Internet Archive. But those are two that I access all the time, and Google Books, obviously. Even though that's a pretty.
The Internet Archive is really neat. One thing that they do is they have an archive of the internet, so they randomly crawl internet pages and save them, so you can see like what Netscape is like. If you remember that.
Mm-hmm. Which is that's what they call the Wayback Machine. Also has like. Way more Grateful Dead music than you could possibly listen to in your lifetime. Whether or not that's something you want to do. Something I enjoy.
So we should.
But we probably ought. I think there's another session probably lurking outside the door. But all of this, you know, all of what we talked about today and more, well, all what we talked about today. And I did find some, you know, Wi-Fi hotspots just by Googling, you know, free. Wi-Fi, New York City, but you know there are
which
some.
Which would presuppose that you have an internet connection.
Well, yeah, it's kind of.
Are there private libraries that you have to pay money to Google?
There are a few subscription libraries. The New York Society Library on 79th and 5th is one.
Mechanics Library.
Mechanics Library. Classic old one.
Yeah. So there are a handful.
What's the other Grolier Club? Which is a sort of a bibliophile organization. They have a great library.
It is open to the public, kinda. But you know, you need to email us in advance. You need to have a specific research requirement. But you know, it's an example of one of those things that's absolutely open to the public, but you need to look at the access page and sort of contact us accordingly, but then absolutely.
And with that, thanks for your patience hanging out in our technical. Thank you for that.